Welcome to Farm to Table Talk, where we talk about our food and how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, this podcast attests to the fact that people are interested in knowing how their food is produced and sometimes dream of being a farmer themselves if they're not one already. They want their food from happy animals, and they just assume the farmers are happy too. Well, maybe they could be happier themselves if they could just farm. Well, that vision is crushed by the depressing news that farmers can be depressed and shockingly have one of the highest rates of suicide of any occupation. Well, my guest today is able to shed light on this happy, sad paradox. Michael Roseman is a psychologist and an Iowa farmer whose life's work involves improving the behavioral health care of the agricultural population. He's been widely featured in media. The New York Times said he speaks the language of men and women on the verge of losing their place on the land, with a promise that joy of farming is also going to work into our conversation today. Mike Roseman agreed to join me. And Mike, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you for asking me to join you, Roger.
Mike, I think a good place to start is give us an example of your own journey. I mean, you grew up on a farm. You left the farm, went to college like I did as well. But you came back to farm country after becoming a psychologist. Tell me a little bit about that journey.
Well, I grew up a mile and a half from where my wife and I live now. I am 71 years old, by the way. But in 1964, after completing high school, I entered a Roman Catholic seminary in Missouri where I studied to be a priest for 3 years. I exhausted all the psychology courses at the seminary college and felt that I needed more background in psychology in order to counsel people if I were to continue in the profession as a clergy. So I went to the University of Colorado for summer school and took psychology courses during the entire summer of 1967. I had a change of heart while I was out there, and it was most unexpected for me. I met a girl who played guitar like I do, and we've often played guitar together. We were not romantically linked. I was confronting her about leaving the United States to travel around Europe when she turned the tables on me and said, "Mike, why are you going back to become a priest? You need to be a father of children, and you need to be a psychologist." I put that out of my mind as best I could, but it didn't disappear, and 3 days later, it felt like it was right for me to continue on in psychology. It didn't go over very well with my parents, I can say. At any rate, though, I eventually enrolled in the University of Utah in the clinical psychology program with the help of people who found a way for me to get in there. I met my wife, who is from Idaho there. We determined that we would try the academic life for a while, although Marilyn always wanted to marry a farmer, and apparently she did. We moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, where I took my first professional position in the Department of Psychology there as an assistant professor. During that time, our children were born, and we began to have second thoughts about raising our family in a region of the country where there were many, for lack of a better term, blue bloods and people who were still fairly traditional in their racial views. Marilyn is Japanese American, and our two children did experience some, I guess I would say, prejudice against them because of their biracial background. We felt that it was best for us to make a move to Iowa or some other place where we could begin our own farming operation, and then we wanted to take advantage of the good schools in Iowa. So in 1979, we moved to our present home, which was an old farmhouse then, but we eventually added on to it. When I was about to leave the University of Virginia in January 1979, I called a meeting of my research associates. I had about a dozen undergraduates, about a half dozen graduate students, and two other psychologists who worked in my research arena. I told them that I would be leaving at the end of May, and they asked, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, we're going to move to Harlan, Iowa, to farm, and I'm going to open up a practice." There were a few snickers in the crowd. They said, "Why do you want to do that?" I didn't know what to say, but in my heart I felt something, and it felt like somebody has to take care of the mental health of farmers, which is why I pursued that when we moved back to Iowa. So over the years, we developed an organic farming operation. Eventually, I did join the faculty at the University of Iowa in the Department of Occupational and Environmental Health. I remain on that faculty as an adjunct professor. But we live, for the most part, in western Iowa, except when I'm traveling around or Marilyn and I are traveling together to give talks to provide lectures on agricultural behavioral health. It's been a wonderful career, and it's really more than a career. It's a way of life and a calling, I feel.
Well, Mike, when you were able to say, "I'm going back to a farm," you actually had a family farm that you could go connect with and be what you started rebuilding or building your farming base from?
Yes, thanks to my parents, they had purchased several farms, and they made it possible for Marilyn and me to take over one of the farms very inexpensively. So we had a place to start out. We did buy two farms in 1980 and 81. We lost two farms in the farm crisis of the 1980s. Subsequently, we bought another farm, and now we own about 190 acres. Mm-hmm. Our operation now is rented out to a nearby farmer because I am gone so much that I can't manage the farm operation as well as the other aspects of my life. So I feel comfortable in the place where we're at in our lives, and I think Marilyn does too. She continues on as a part-time professor of behavioral health at Clarkson College. It's a small healthcare and nursing school in Omaha.
You know, you remind me, when I left the farm and went to Illinois State University, I just took all the courses I thought were interesting, and it turned out to be nothing on agriculture. It was psychology, sociology, and communications, and then I've spent my whole career in agriculture since then. And you also remind me about other people that are kind of at a fork in the road.
Yes.
And think they want to go back to the farm. Many of them don't have farm connections anymore. I've talked to some that are just kind of looking at the entire map of not only just the United States, but even around the world. And they're almost saying, "Gee, I'm going to try that." And with different kinds of programs, like some of the, what do they call it? Woofers. You know, they've had experience on organic farms around the world and getting a start. And people are helping people, just giving them some land that they ordinarily wouldn't have, even if they're not in the family. So it's they're at an interesting crossroads, and those choices are being made. When you got back to Iowa and you were starting to make the farm work, at first, before you were you still doing being a psychologist? That was
yes, I had a full-time practice of psychology, Roger, and I was also working full-time as a farmer. So I was kind of burning the candle at both ends.
People do that. And did you have livestock too, or just crops?
We did have livestock. I developed a herd of registered Simmental cattle. We raised bulls and breeding stock for other farmers and ranchers around the country.
Well, let's switch now to the troubles on the farm. How
Sure.
would you describe the situation? I mean, how do you explain the level of suicides that seem to be taking place in agriculture and farming, not just in the United States, but apparently around the world? They are at greater rates than other occupations, is that right?
That is correct. A major article came out from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in early July 2016. This study showed that in 17 states, farmers were more likely to take their lives than any other occupational group. Subsequently, several more studies were released that looked at occupational suicide in the workplace, and it verified that farming just during work hours results in more suicides than any other occupation. The rate of suicide among farmers is more than double that of returning veterans who have performed military service. It is almost twice as high as the next closest occupation, which is heavy construction. So there's something unique about farming that contributes to this tendency to take their own lives. And we're still trying to figure that out. We don't have all the answers. We know that exposures to certain toxic agricultural chemicals, particularly insecticides, contributes to a heightened increase in farming depression and ultimately suicide. But it's more than that. I have developed a theory that I like to call the agrarian imperative that is based on three lines of research evidence that is genetic, also evidence that's anthropological, and then a look at what are the psychological factors that farm people exhibit in order to be successful in the agricultural field. So the agrarian imperative is something that contributed to the welfare of humans when we emerged from being hunter-gatherers and became agricultural communities. We acquired land to produce essentials for life so that the human population could survive and expand, and that certainly did occur after agriculture came along, when we no longer had to follow the migration of animal herds or go to new territories to find the seeds and fruits that we were gathering. When we settled down and raised our own crops, it gave enormous stability to the modern human race. Humans then expanded into other trades because we had time to do that when we didn't have that time as hunter-gatherers. So we specialized and became builders and teachers and scientists. Some were the practitioners of medical arts. And we had our first behavioral health therapist in the form of witch doctors who listened to people's complaints and cast spells on people that they wanted to have hexes on. So agriculture contributed immensely to the well-being of humans. We still carry that genetic urge in our DNA. Sometimes it's latent and doesn't come out readily, but I can cite many instances where people have been removed from working the land for several generations and now are engaged in agriculture, such as raising salad greens hydroponically or tomatoes hydroponically. In other cases, purchasing small plots of land to begin their own community agricultural business. So agricultural urges, I think, continue to be a formative part of our DNA, and it's interesting how we can fall back into the behaviors of ancestors once we begin tilling the soil and working with animals once again.
You know, Mike, that reminds me, I'm always amazed at people that make $1 billion, literally anymore. It used to be,
sure,
say, a million, but now it's like a billion, and then want to become farmers. I did a podcast with Steve Forbes, and you can tell he just loves the cow herd he's got in Northern,
yep,
Virginia. And for all the billions that the Forbeses have, he likes to get out there, and he and his wife both feed the cows. I do have to ask you, though, what effect prices play in it, because in the early 80s, it was horrible. I can't even count the number of people I know that went broke farming, and unfortunately knew of some suicides at that time as well. It was an especially bad time. So is there a correlation that when the economics are especially bad, that there's many more suicides than in good times?
You're right about that, Roger. During the farm crisis of the 1980s, the rate of suicide by farmers rose to 4 times the average rate preceding the farm crisis. That was the era of very severe economic turmoil for farmers. Prices were low. Interest rates were terribly high, 17 to 21%. We lost some of our overseas markets for grains because of conflict with the Soviet Union at that time. It was a rough era. Since then, we've learned a lot more, and we do see a pattern that during episodes of economic stress, the incidence of anxiety disorders and depression increase among farm people. It has something to do with wanting to hang on to the land. When people feel that the resources they have acquired or their ancestors have acquired to produce food and fibers, when those resources are threatened economically, they go to great lengths to try to hang on to the land and to the livestock or machinery. Sometimes when they are unable to hang on to these agricultural assets, they feel personally responsible for letting down their ancestors and not allowing subsequent successors to take on or take over the business eventually. So the rate of self-harm and self-blame increases dramatically during times of farm economy downturns. We're seeing a little bit of that right now. We're reaching toward the tail end of an agricultural recession that has endured for 3 years. And we did once again notice an increase in suicide among farmers, not as dramatic as the 1980s, but a noticeable increase in calls to farm crisis telephone hotlines and an increase that's documented in coroner's reports that are gathered and reported back to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
That's a really interesting insight. I've never really thought of it quite like that before, Mike, that the people feeling tied up in trying, that it's their responsibility to keep the land in the family or the equipment to,
yeah,
the livestock and to lose that and just really be hard on themselves. I mean, they've enjoyed the lifestyle, which that's one thing you mentioned earlier, that farming has been a lifestyle.
If
you, yes, I think compare that to what you say is more of an industrial model, which is a lot more transactional, about making money and return on investment and so forth. And it's not that that romanticized, maybe in some extent, lifestyle. And I'm sitting here as I'm talking to you. I now live on the coast of California. And I get out and take a hike on the beach where I used to walk through the cornfields in the Midwest. And now I can get out and take a hike on the beach. But it never occurs to me that there's none of the beach that's owned by anybody. Where we are, we can walk for 20 miles in either direction, and it's all public. You can just park your car and get out there, and you never think, well, I could lose this beach. You know, this is a place I love and I'm enjoying, and you know, I don't have the pressure on to kind of keep it. But farm, I mean, this is a crazy analogy, but farming in a way is almost the beach in that it's got beauty, it's got all kinds of emotional ties to it.
Yes.
That people are taking a very personal responsibility for its failure.
Well, again, I agree with you very much. If we look at what are the characteristics or factors that make farmers become successful, research has pointed to several psychological traits. One of them is a capacity to endure much hardship. A second trait that shows up in successful farmers is to be a high risk taker. A third tendency or factor of successful farming farmers is to have confidence in their own decisions and to take responsibility for them, and then a capacity to rely on oneself and to work alone also is another factor that is correlated with being successful as a farmer. Now, some of these traits also work against farmers during times of economic turmoil, so that they tend to be reluctant to reach out for help because they want to rely on themselves and are more comfortable holding things in than getting them out in the open. That is slowly changing over the past decade or two with education, with people figuring out that the more I manage my behavioral health, the more I can control an important factor in my capacity to work. So we are seeing people pay attention to that, to these psychological behaviors and factors. But we don't have adequate resources in our farming communities and in many agricultural states and regions of the country and around the world, for that matter. We don't have adequate resources to help farm people learn to manage themselves when they are becoming overly anxious and depressed.
But is what you're describing here, is it universal?
It does seem to be universal. If we look at the rate of suicide in farm people in Australia versus non-farm people, the incidence of suicide is much higher. It's higher in nearly every country of the world, India, as you say, but even Great Britain, which we think of as a very civilized country. The rate of suicide during the early 2000s, when livestock, cattle, and sheep were being gathered together and incinerated because of foot and mouth disease and bovine spongiform encephalitis. During that era, farmers were so distraught at seeing their beloved livestock being incinerated that the rate of suicide temporarily rose to 10 times the average rate among British farmers. That also occurred in mainland Europe. So everything that we've seen pretty much says that the agrarian imperative seems to be a universal characteristic of successful farming, but also of farmers who have to struggle.
What should we be doing from a societal standpoint to support healthy changes to reduce this, tragic numbers that we are talking about?
Well, other people may have their own suggestions too, but our work here in the Midwest indicated that farm crisis telephone hotlines and electronic outlets, websites, even Facebook, all of these electronic and social media help farmers to deal with their turmoil when it occurs. They are apt to reach out to resources that are confidential, are competent, that is, the people that they converse with have to know something about farming. If they don't, there's a credibility gap, and farm people are reluctant to take their problems to someone who doesn't understand farming or ranching. We also see that they need to have access to several sessions of counseling for free. Why for free? Well, often farm people in trouble economically have very high deductibles on their health insurance, so they would have to pay for counseling out of their pocket when they don't have adequate funds. Another reason that it probably should be free is that if people go to see a professional provider of behavioral health care, like a psychiatrist or psychologist, the provider turns in the claim to an insurance company that keeps track of such things as depression. Depression becomes a chronic illness, which then has a rider placed on it for subsequent purchase of health insurance and purchase of life insurance. So farmers need to have a way of obtaining help that at least starts the ball rolling to working through their problems. We think that an employee assistance plan for farmers would do a lot to save lives and to educate and improve the emotional well-being of farm people.
But what do you mean, an employee assistance plan?
Well, you're aware of what employee assistance programs are for industry, where employees can go to a counseling service that is funded by the employer. These employee assistance programs have a well-established track record of improving the well-being of their employees, and that's why it is offered as a benefit in many employment settings.
Well, the only thing is that in this kind of Uber economy, unfortunately, there's less and less of those, but as more people are having to do gigs that don't have any kind of benefits, but that's almost another podcast.
Yeah, we do see that, but we also do see that the loss of a job or unemployment makes people at risk for depression and increases their own rate of suicide. It's just that among farm people, the rate of depression and suicide when they are in danger of losing their land and their employment on it, their rate of suicide is much higher than for the general population. So I think that the United States Department of Agriculture has as its first obligation to take care of the most important asset in farming and agriculture, and that's the people who are the producers of food and fiber and increasingly renewable energy. So I would like to see a government-sponsored employee assistance program. Maybe it would be called something different, but it could be funded and operated through our farm service agencies. It actually was part of the 2008 Farm Bill, but subsequently Congress failed to pass any appropriation of money, so it was never enacted. It is, however, cited as a best practice program by the Department of Health and Human Services at our federal level. Wherever we have farm crisis hotlines and counseling services, and there are only five states that yet retain these kinds of services, the suicide rate is lower in these areas, and that speaks to itself about how effective these services are.
That's a really interesting perspective, and this seems like a tough time to get government to spend more, perhaps, but I suppose even state agriculture departments or state legislatures might be able to do something. And somehow we come up with the money for various farm programs, and we spend nearly $1 billion I can think of off the top of my head just in support of international market promotions and farmers markets promotion and all sorts of things to help on the marketing side. So why not be doing what you're suggesting? It seems like that it's just a matter of priorities.
You're right about that. We're looking at a service or a program that would probably cost in the range of $20 to $25 million, not billion. That's a drop in the bucket. Every time we lose a farmer who may have quite a few years of productive life left if he didn't take his own life, that farmer would contribute by himself or herself about $1.8 million at today's rate of income generated by individual farmers. So you can see it wouldn't take very many losses of farmers to offset the expense of a federally funded farm crisis network.
I think that's a great idea, Mike. And I can think of so many programs that exceed $25 million.
Yeah. And we do need a variety of ways of funding it. Nebraska does a particularly good job. Their state legislature helps to fund it. They also take up a church collection once a year, and the proceeds are used to fund their hotline and to make counseling sessions available to farmers and ranchers, up to 5 sessions per family. We do need the farm corporations and farmer organizations like Farm Bureau and other groups to step up to the plate to assist in setting up such support networks.
Mike, I want to wrap up with a couple things. One is, let's talk about a farmer that's feeling depressed. So if a person is into farming and is feeling really depressed and starting to worry about and have thoughts that are much darker than they've ever had before.
Yeah.
What are, kind of briefly, I'm not trying to have you be the, you know, our psychiatrist on the air here, but I mean, briefly, what are the things that you can identify that you can say, I can recognize that this, I'm at a stage where I better get some help. I need someone to help me work through this because it's getting into dangerous territory. It's not just the same old, you know, cloudy day.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, now farmers are more likely to reach out than they were a generation ago, but still there is that reluctance. The first place I would recommend people start is by visiting the family doctor. Whether this is a medical doctor or a DO or a nurse practitioner or whoever, but to talk about things that are going on emotionally. It's more acceptable to approach a healthcare professional than it is a counselor or a behavioral health therapist. That's a place to start, but the farmer must report the use of farm chemicals because depression can also include the exposure to the dangerous farm chemicals, and we need to know how to make a differential diagnosis so we don't mistreat the illness. It has to be diagnosed correctly. In fact, to treat what looks like depression with a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor can actually worsen the depression and maladjustment of a farmer who has been exposed to agricultural insecticides. Well, besides seeing the family doctor, I think there is a need for family members, work associates, anybody that the farmer encounters and who detects signs of depression, lack of pleasure, talking down, and not having anything to look forward to, something I call the lump in the throat phenomena, where they feel like they need to cry but can't. If their appearance has deteriorated, or the farming operation looks to be going downhill, those are all signs that we need to pay attention to.
Do you say something to them? Do you go say, you know, John or Mary or whoever the farmer is, and saying, you know, I think things are getting you down. How's it going? Or did you ever think about talking to somebody? Or, you know, I mean, what do you do when you recognize that in someone?
You do just what you said. You stop by and you say, I'm a little worried about you. I'm wondering if you have visited with any professional about what is going on. And then encouraging the person to seek help. That's why farm crisis hotlines work, because they are anonymous and farmers can reach out to them. But in places where we don't have farm crisis hotlines and services, it is up to others to take responsibility for linking farmers with appropriate resources.
Maybe they go back. They've talked to their doctor. That might not be satisfactory. Maybe it is. Are there county offices, or I suppose most counties actually have somebody that is a psychiatrist or psychologist that that they could try to get an appointment to visit with? What about clergy?
Clergy, anybody who has some expertise and is a wise person. Sometimes it can be a neighbor or an elderly person who's becoming a mentor for younger people. It could be a teacher. It's important that the person who is struggling talk to someone about what's going on. There are not enough psychiatrists and psychologists or professionals in the behavioral health professions in rural areas. In fact, the number of psychiatrists and psychologists per 100,000 persons in rural counties of the U.S. is less than half the rate of psychiatrists and psychologists per 100,000 in urban areas. So it's important to reach out to auxiliary providers such as the family doctors or pastors or extension personnel. In some cases, when we're not sure who we can approach, it's feasible to call or email the state professional associations like the California Psychological Association or the California Association of Behavioral Health Counselors. Often the personnel at these administrative offices know who has a rural background and who might be more suited to assist a farm person in need of assistance.
I promised people that we would touch on joy, and it seems like an appropriate transition to joy is that there are people that are talking about getting in agriculture. I hope our long conversations hasn't necessarily discouraged them, because, you know, it can have issues. So what do you tell those people that feel like, boy, I'm one again into farming. I hate what I'm doing right now, and I like so much it's appealing about it. I mean, as they're standing at the brink and ready to plunge in or just getting started, what Sure. counsel do you have to them to not find them in the place that we're talking about, that's that dark space where they all of a sudden think, oh my God, what have I gotten into, and feel the depression setting in? So if they're standing at that door, what advice do you have to the new farmer?
Well, first of all, we all have to eat. We all have to wear clothing. We all need lumber for building. So we're going to have farmers around for a long time. The downturns in a farm economy are like downturns in other general economies. They are cyclical. They're not always enduring. What works best Well, the industrial model works for very large-scale farmers, but not very many people can get into taking over a large farm. You have to have a family member who is well-connected or maybe is leaving the operation. The number of large farms is declining, even though they are increasing in their individual sizes. The most common type of farming that is expanding rapidly is organic or sustainable farming. This seems to be an approach that consumers are in tune with, and it turns out that beginning farmers who want to raise organic food require less capital, less, let's say, equipment getting started than the large industrial model type farmers. There also are very good support systems for both types of farmers, industrial or sustainable. Many family farmers are somewhere in between those two models. They may want to be a large scale, or they may wish to specialize organic products. The point, though, is that people who grew up on organic farms are more likely to enter the agricultural profession than persons in the large industrial scale approach to farming.
It's easier to do.
It is easier to do, and they feel better about doing it because they feel like they're working in harmony with nature rather than perhaps contributing to pollution or environmental issues.
I have to go back to something else because you just reminded me. When you were talking about people that are going into organic, you went into organic, and then you said several times in this conversation that chemicals may play a role. Did that have anything to do with your decision to go into organic, that you viewed that there was risk associated with being surrounded with the chemicals that are necessary for larger scale kind of industrialized approach? Fumbling with the right wording there, but
sure.
But did that play a part in your deciding to go organic?
It did. The research was just beginning to be accumulated that raised questions. You have to remember that Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, came out in the late 1960s and was popular in the 70s. So there was concern that we can harm our environment.
Well, Mike, I promised that we were going to mention joy, and I'm afraid that we're just going to have to mention the fact you've written a book about joy, and it's called Excellent Joy, and I just got my copy delivered yesterday. I ordered it from the Whole Foods book company online, Amazon, of course. And so it came in, I started reading, I really enjoyed it, and I like the fact you say fishing, farming, hunting, and psychology. And I think for those that have been hearing us talk about all the ways that we can be depressed, you also have many examples that are, I've gone skimmed through and read some of the stories already.
Well, I'm glad for what you just said, Roger, and thank you. I think that being a farmer has made me a better psychologist, but also being a psychologist has made me a better farmer. I know that I found my calling in combining psychology with agriculture, and is indeed my life's work and passion, and that's where my joy is found.
I tell you what, we're all lucky that you're enjoying this and that you're making these contributions. And if people want to know more about your work, about your writing, about where you're speaking, I just want to reach out. How do they follow up with you or your books and other information?
Well, there's a couple of ways. The organization that I helped to initiate was called Agro Wellness, AgriWellness. If people Google Agro Wellness, they can reach its website. It's being modified and updated just as we're talking, or they can Google my name or the words agricultural behavioral health. I have a personal website, Ag Behavioral Health. All you have to do is use the letters AG and then behavioralhealth.com, all one word. So I hope that people will contact me, and I try to respond.
Well, you know what? I hope they do, too. And we have people listening literally all over the world to Farm to Table Talk now.
Good.
And so I'm hoping that somebody hears us this today, and it helps them, or it gives them the reason, I think, to help somebody else. So, Mike Roseman, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk. Thank you.
And thank you, Roger, for asking me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk.